This is Audible.
This is a copyrighted work. Unauthorized copying or distribution is a crime punishable by up to 5 years in prison and a fine of $250,000.
Scholastic Audio presents The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, a Hunger Games novel, by Suzanne Collins, read by Santino Fontana. For Norton and Jean Jester. Hereby it is manifest that during the time men live without a common power to keep them all in awe, they are in that condition which is called war, and such a war as is of every man against every man. Thomas Hobbes, Leviathan, 1651. The state of nature has a law of nature to govern it, which obliges everyone. And reason, which is that law, teaches all mankind, who will but consult it, that being all equal and independent, no one ought to harm another in his life, health, liberty, or possessions. John Locke, Second Treatise of Government, 1689. Man is born free, and everywhere he is in chains. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, The Social Contract, 1762. Sweet is the lore which nature brings. Our meddling intellect misshapes the beauteous forms of things, we murder to dissect. William Wordsworth, The Tables Turned, Lyrical Ballads, 1798. I thought of the promise of virtues which he had displayed on the opening of his existence, and the subsequent blight of all kindly feeling by the loathing and scorn which his protectors had manifested towards him. Mary Shelley, Frankenstein, 1818. Part 1. The Mentor. Chapter 1. Coriolanus released the fistful of cabbage into the pot of boiling water and swore that one day it would never pass his lips again. But this was not that day. He needed to eat a large bowl of the anemic stuff and drink every drop of broth to prevent his stomach from growling during the reaping ceremony. It was one of a long list of precautions he took to mask the fact that his family, despite residing in the penthouse of the capital's most opulent apartment building, was as poor as district scum. That at 18, the heir to the once great house of snow had nothing to live on but his wits. His shirt for the reaping was worrying him. He had an acceptable pair of dark dress pants bought on the black market last year, but the shirt was what people looked at. Fortunately, the academy provided the uniforms it required for daily use. For today's ceremony, however, students were instructed to be dressed fashionably but with the solemnity the occasion dictated. Tigris had said to trust her, and he did. Only his cousin's cleverness with a needle had saved him so far. Still, he couldn't expect miracles. The shirt they dug from the back of the wardrobe, his father's, from better days, was stained and yellowed with age, half the buttons missing, a cigarette burn on one cuff, too damaged to sell in even the worst of times. And this was to be his reaping shirt? This morning he had gone to her room at daybreak, only to find both his cousin and the shirt missing. Not a good sign. Had Tigris given up on the old thing and braved the black market in some last-ditch effort to find him proper clothing? And what on earth would she possess worth trading for it? Only one thing, herself. And the House of Snow had not yet fallen that far. Or was it falling now as he salted the cabbage? He thought of people putting a price on her. With her long, pointed nose and skinny body, Tigris was no great beauty, but she had a sweetness, a vulnerability that invited abuse. She would find takers if she had a mind to. The idea made him feel sick and helpless, and consequently disgusted with himself. From deep in the apartment, he heard the recording of the capital anthem, Gem of Panem, kick on. His grandmother's tremulous soprano voice joined in, bouncing off the walls.
Gem of Panem, mighty city, through the ages you shine anew.
As always, she was painfully off-key and slightly behind tempo. The first year of the war, she'd played the recording on national holidays for 5-year-old Coriolanus and 8-year-old Tigris in order to build their sense of patriotism. The daily recital hadn't begun until that black day when the district rebels had surrounded the capital, cutting it off from supplies for the remaining 2 years of the war.
"Remember, children," she'd say, "we are but besieged. We have not surrendered."
Then she would warble the anthem out of the penthouse window as the bombs rained down. Her small act of defiance.
"We humbly kneel to your ideal,"
and the notes she could never quite hit,
"and pledge our love to you."
Coriolanus winced a little. For a decade now, though the rebels had been silent, his grandmother had not. There were still 2 verses to go.
"Gem of Panem, heart of justice, wisdom crowns your marble brow."
He wondered if more furniture might absorb some of the sound, but the question was academic. At present, their penthouse apartment was a microcosm of the capital itself, bearing the scars of the relentless rebel attacks. The 20-foot-high walls were veined with cracks. The molded ceiling was dotted with holes from missing chunks of plaster, and ugly black strips of electrical tape held in place the broken glass of the arched windows that looked out over the city. Throughout the war and the decade that followed, the family had been forced to sell or trade many of its possessions, so that some rooms were entirely empty and closed off, and the others sparsely furnished at best. Even worse, during the bitter cold of the siege's final winter, several elegant carved wooden pieces and innumerable volumes of books had been sacrificed to the fireplace to keep the family from freezing to death. Watching the bright pages of his picture books, the very ones he'd pored over with his mother, reduced to ashes, had never failed to bring him to tears. But better off sad than dead. Having been in his friends' apartments, Coriolanus knew that most families had begun to repair their homes, but the Snows could not even afford a few yards of linen for a new shirt. He thought of his classmates, rifling through their closets or slipping into their newly tailored suits, and wondered just how long he could keep up appearances.
"You give us light, you reunite, to you we make our vow."
If Tigris's revamped shirt was unwearable, what was he to do? Fake the flu and call in sick? Spineless. Soldier through in his uniform shirt? Disrespectful. Squeeze into the red button-down that he had outgrown 2 years ago? Poor. Acceptable option? None of the above. Perhaps Tigris had gone to ask help from her employer, Fabricia Whatnot, a woman as ridiculous as her name but with a certain talent for derivative fashion. Whether the trend was feathers or leathers, plastics or plush, she could find a way to incorporate it at a reasonable rate. Not much of a student, Tigris had foregone university when she'd graduated from the academy to pursue her dream of becoming a designer. She was supposed to be an apprentice, although Fabricia used her more as slave labor, requiring her to give foot massages and clean clumps of her long magenta hair from the drains. But Tigris never complained and would hear no criticism of her boss. So pleased and grateful was she to have a position in fashion.
"Gem of Panem, seat of power, strength in peacetime, shield in strife."
Coriolanus opened the refrigerator, hoping for something to liven up the cabbage soup. The sole occupant was a metal saucepan. When he removed the lid, A mush of congealed, shredded potatoes stared back at him. Had his grandmother finally made good her threat of learning to cook? Was the stuff even edible? He replaced the lid until he had more information to work with. What a luxury it would be to toss it in the trash without a second thought. What a luxury trash would be. He remembered, or thought he did, being very small and watching garbage trucks operated by Avoxes. Tongueless workers made the best workers, or so his grandmother said, humming down the streets, emptying large bags of discarded food, containers, worn household items. Then came the time when nothing was disposable. No calorie unwanted, and no item unable to be traded, or burned for heat, or tucked against a wall for insulation. Everyone had learned to despise waste. It was creeping back into fashion, though. A sign of prosperity, like a decent shirt.
Protect our land with armored hand.
The shirt. The shirt. His mind could fixate on a problem like that, anything really, and not let go. As if controlling one element of his world would keep him from ruin. It was a bad habit that blinded him to other things that could harm him. A tendency toward obsession was hardwired into his brain, and would likely be his undoing if he couldn't learn to outsmart it. His grandmother's voice squeaked out the final crescendo.
Our capital, our life.
Crazy old woman, still clinging to the pre-war days. He loved her, but she'd lost touch with reality years ago. Every meal she'd rattle on about the snow's legendary grandeur, even when their fare consisted of watery bean soup and stale crackers. And to hear her tell it, it was a given that his future would be glorious.
When Coriolanus is president,
she often began.
When Coriolanus is president.
Everything from the rickety Capitol Air Force to the exorbitant price of pork chops would be magically corrected. Thank goodness the broken elevator and her arthritic knees prevented her from going out much, and her infrequent visitors were as fossilized as she. The cabbage began to boil, filling the kitchen with the smell of poverty. Coriolanus jabbed at it with a wooden spoon. Still no tigress. Soon it would be too late to call and make an excuse. Everyone would have assembled at the Academy's Heavensby Hall. There would be anger to deal with, as well as disappointment from his communications professor, Sateria Click, who had campaigned for him to receive one of the 24 coveted mentorships in the Hunger Games. Besides being Sateria's favorite, he was her teaching aide, and doubtless she would need him for something today. She could be unpredictable, especially when she'd been drinking, and that was a given on the day of the reaping. He'd better call and warn her. Say he couldn't stop vomiting, or something, but would do his best to recover. He steeled himself and picked up the phone to plead dire illness when another thought hit him. If he failed to show, would she allow them to replace him as a mentor? And if she did, would that weaken his chance for one of the Academy prizes presented at graduation? Without such a prize, he had no way to afford to go to university, which meant no career, which meant no future, not for him. And who knew what would happen to the family? And the front door, warped and complaining, scraped open.
Corio!
Tigress cried out, and he slammed the phone down. The nickname she'd given him when he was a newborn had stuck. He flew out of the kitchen, almost knocking her over, but she was too excited to reproach him.
I did it! I did it! Well, I did something!
Her feet did a rapid little run in place as she held up a hanger draped in an old dress bag.
Look, look, look!
Coriolanus unzipped the bag and stripped it from the shirt. It was gorgeous. No, even better, it was classy. The thick linen was neither the original white nor the yellow of age, but a delicious cream. The cuffs and collar had been replaced with black velvet, and the buttons were gold and ebony cubes. Tesserae. Each had two tiny holes drilled through it for the thread. You're brilliant, he said earnestly, and the best cousin ever. Careful to hold the shirt out of harm's way, he hugged her with his free arm.
Snow lands on top.
Snow lands on top, Tigress crowed.
It was the saying that had gotten them through the war, when it was a constant struggle not to be ground into the earth. Tell me everything, he said, knowing she would want to. She so loved to talk clothes. Tigress threw up her hands and gave a breathy laugh.
Where to begin?
She began with the bleach. Tigress had suggested the white curtains in Fabricia's bedroom looked dingy, and while soaking them in bleach water, had slipped in the shirt. It had responded beautifully, but no amount of soaking could entirely erase the stains. So she'd boiled the shirt with dead marigolds she'd found in the bin outside Fabricia's neighbors, and the blossoms had dyed the linen just enough to conceal the stains. The velvet for the cuffs was from a large drawstring pouch that had held some now meaningless plaque of their grandfather's. The tesserae she had pried from the interior of a cabinet in the maid's bathroom. She'd gotten the building maintenance man to drill the holes in exchange for mending his coveralls.
Was that this morning? He asked.
Oh, no. Yesterday. Sunday. This morning I... Did you find my potatoes?
He followed her into the kitchen, where she opened the refrigerator and pulled out the pan.
I was up until all hours making starch from them. Then I ran down to the Doolittle so I could have a proper iron. Saved these for the soup.
Tigress upended the mess into the boiling cabbage and stirred it around. He noticed the lilac circles under her golden brown eyes and couldn't help feeling a pang of guilt.
When was the last time you slept? He asked.
Oh, I'm fine. I ate the potato skins. They say that's where the vitamins are anyway. And today's the reaping, so it's practically a holiday, she said cheerfully.
Not at Fabricia's, he said. Not anywhere, really. Reaping day was terrible in the districts, but not much of a celebration in the capital, either. Like him, most people took no pleasure in remembering the war. Tigress would spend the day waiting hand and foot on her employer and her motley crew of guests while they exchanged morose tales of the deprivation they'd experienced during the siege and drank themselves senseless. Tomorrow, nursing them through hangovers, would be worse.
Stop worrying! Here, you better hurry up and eat.
Tigress ladled some soup into a bowl and set it on the table. Coriolanus glanced at the clock, gulped down the soup without caring that it burned his mouth, and ran to his room with the shirt. He had already showered and shaved, and his fair skin was thankfully blemish-free today. The school-issued underwear and black socks were fine. He pulled on the dress pants, which were more than acceptable, and crammed his feet into a pair of laced leather boots. They were too small, but he could bear it. Then he pulled the shirt on gingerly, tucked in the tails, and turned to the mirror. He was not as tall as he should have been. As for so many of his generation, a poor diet had likely compromised his growth. But he was athletically trim, with excellent posture, and the shirt emphasized the finer points of his physique. Not since he was little, when his grandmother would parade him through the streets in a purple velvet suit, had he looked so regal. He smoothed back his blonde curls as he mockingly whispered to his image,
Coriolanus Snow, future president of Pan Am, I salute you.
For Tigress's sake, he made a grand entrance into the living room, extending his arms and turning in a full circle to show off the shirt. She squealed in delight and applauded.
You look amazing, so handsome and fashionable. Come see, Grandmam.
It was another nickname coined by Little Tigress, who had found Grandma, and certainly Nana, insufficient for someone so imperial. Their grandmother appeared, a fresh-cut red rose cupped lovingly in her tremorous hands. She wore a long black flowing tunic, the kind so popular before the war, and so outdated as to be laughable now, and a pair of embroidered slippers with curled toes that had once been part of a costume. Strands of her thin, white hair poked from the bottom of a rusty velvet turban. This was the tail end of a once lavish wardrobe. Her few decent items were saved for company or the rare foray into the city.
"Here, here, boy, put this on. Fresh from my roof garden," she ordered.
He reached for the rose, but a thorn pierced his palm in the shaky exchange. Blood welled from the wound, and he held his hand out to keep it from staining his precious shirt. His grandmother seemed perplexed.
"I only wanted you to look elegant," she told him.
"Of course you did, Grandmam," said Tigress. "And so he shall."
As she led Coriolanus into the kitchen, he reminded himself that self-control was an essential skill, and he should be grateful his grandmother provided daily opportunities to practice it.
"Puncture wounds never bleed long,"
Tigress promised him as she quickly cleaned and bandaged his hand. She snipped away at the rose, preserving a bit of greenery, and pinned it to his shirt.
"It does look elegant. You know what her roses mean to her. Thank her."
So he did. He thanked them both and sped out the door. Down the 12 ornate flights of stairs, through the lobby, and out into the capital. His front door opened onto the Corso, an avenue so wide that 8 chariots had comfortably ridden side by side on it in the old days when the capital had put on displays of military pomp for the crowds. Coriolanus could remember hanging out the apartment windows as a young child, party guests bragging that they had front row seats to the parades. Then the bombers arrived, and for a long time his block was impassable. Now, though the streets were finally clear, rubble still lay in piles on the sidewalks, and whole buildings were as gutted as the day they'd been struck. 10 years after the victory, and he was dodging between chunks of marble and granite as he wove his way to the academy. Sometimes Coriolanus wondered if the debris had been left there to remind the citizens of what they had endured. People had short memories. They needed to navigate the rubble, peel off the grubby ration coupons, and witness the Hunger Games to keep the war fresh in their minds. Forgetting could lead to complacency, and then they'd all be back at square one. As he turned onto Scholar's Road, he tried to measure his pace. He wanted to arrive on time, but cool and composed, not a sweaty mess. This reaping day, like most, was shaping up to be a scorcher. But what else could you expect on July 4th? He felt grateful for the perfume of his grandmother's rose, as his warming shirt was giving off a faint scent of potatoes and dead marigolds. As the finest secondary school in the capital, the academy educated the offspring of the prominent, wealthy, and influential. With over 400 students in each class, it had been possible for Tigris and Coriolanus, given their family's long history at the school, to gain acceptance without much difficulty. Unlike the university, it was tuition-free and provided lunch and school supplies along with uniforms. Anyone who was anyone attended the academy, and Coriolanus would need those connections as a foundation for his future. The grand staircase up to the academy could hold the entire student body, so it easily accommodated the stream of officials, professors, and students headed for the Reaping Day festivities. Coriolanus climbed it slowly, attempting a casual dignity in case he caught anyone's eye. People knew him, or at least they had known his parents and grandparents, and there was a certain standard expected of a Snow. This year, beginning this very day, he was hoping to achieve personal recognition as well. Mentoring in the Hunger Games was his final project before graduating from the academy in midsummer. If he gave an impressive performance as a mentor with his outstanding academic record, Coriolanus should be awarded a monetary prize substantial enough to cover his tuition at the university. There would be 24 tributes. One boy and one girl from each of the 12 defeated districts, drawn by lottery to be thrown into an arena to fight to the death in the Hunger Games. It was all laid out in the Treaty of Treason that had ended the dark days of the district's rebellion, one of the many punishments borne by the rebels. As in the past, the tributes would be dumped into the capital arena, a now dilapidated amphitheater that had been used for sports and entertainment events before the war, along with some weapons to murder one another. Viewing was encouraged in the capital, but a lot of people avoided it. How to make it more engaging was the challenge. With this in mind, for the first time, the tributes were to be assigned mentors. 24 of the Academy's best and brightest seniors had been tapped for the job. The specifics of what this entailed were still being worked out. There was talk of preparing each tribute for a personal interview, maybe some grooming for the cameras. Everyone agreed that if the Hunger Games were to continue, they needed to evolve into a more meaningful experience, and the pairing of the capital youth with the district tributes had people intrigued. Coriolanus made his way through an entry draped in black banners, down a vaulted passage, and into cavernous Heavensby Hall, where they would watch the broadcast of the reaping ceremony. He was by no means late, but the hall was already humming with faculty and students and a number of games officials who were not required for the opening day's broadcast. Avoxes wove through the crowds with trays of posca, a concoction of watery wine laced with honey and herbs. It was an intoxicating version of the sour stuff that had sustained the capital through the war, supposedly fending off illness. Coriolanus took a goblet and swished a little of the posca around his mouth, hopefully rinsing away any trace of cabbage breath. But he only allowed himself one swallow. It was stronger than most people thought, and in previous years he had seen upperclassmen make complete fools of themselves by imbibing too deeply. The world still thought Coriolanus rich, but his only real currency was charm, which he spread liberally as he made his way through the crowd. Faces lit up as he gave friendly hellos to students and teachers alike, asking about family members, dropping compliments here and there. "Your lecture on district retaliation haunts me. Love the bangs. How did your mother's back surgery go? Well, tell her she's my hero." He traveled past the hundreds of cushioned chairs set up for the occasion and onto the dais, where Satyria was regaling a mix of academy professors and games officials with some wild story. Although he only caught the last line, "Well, I said, I'm sorry about your wig, but you were the one who insisted on bringing a monkey." He dutifully joined in the laughter that followed. "Oh, Coriolanus," Satyria drawled as she waved him over. "Here's my star pupil." He gave her the expected kiss on the cheek and registered that she was several glasses of posca ahead of him. Really, she needed to get her drinking under control, although the same thing could be said for half the adults he knew. Self-medication was a citywide epidemic. Still, she was amusing and not overly uptight, one of the few professors who allowed students to call them by their first names. She drew back a bit and surveyed him. "Beautiful shirt. Where did you get such a thing?" He looked at the shirt as if surprised by its existence and gave the shrug of a young man of limitless options. "The snows have deep closets," he said airily. "I was trying for respectful yet celebratory."
"And so it is. What are these cunning buttons?"
Satyria asked, fingering one of the cubes on his cuff.
"Tesserae?"
"Are they? Well, that explains why they remind me of the maid's bathroom," Coriolanus responded, drawing a chuckle from her friends. This was the impression he fought to sustain, a reminder that he was the rare person who had a maid's bathroom, let alone one tiled with tesserae, tempered with a self-deprecating joke about his shirt. He nodded at Satyria. "Lovely gown. It's new, isn't it?" He could tell at a glance that it was the same dress she always wore to the reaping ceremony, refurbished with tufts of black feathers. But she had validated his shirt, and he needed to return the favor.
"I had it done especially for today," she said, embracing the question. "10th anniversary and all that."
"Elegant," he said. All in all, they were not a bad team. His pleasure drained as he spotted the gymnasium mistress, Professor Agrippina Sickle, using her muscular shoulders to maneuver her way through the crowd. Behind her was her aide, Sejanus Plinth, who was carrying the ornamental shield Professor Sickle insisted on holding for the group photo each year. It had been awarded to her at the end of the war for successfully overseeing Academy safety drills during the bombings. It was not the shield that caught Coriolanus's attention, but Sejanus's outfit, a soft charcoal gray suit with a blinding white shirt offset by a paisley tie, cut to add flow to his tall, angular frame. The ensemble was stylish, brand new, and smelling of money. War profiteering, to be exact. Sejanus's father was a District 2 manufacturer who had sided with the president. He had made such a fortune off munitions that he'd been able to buy his family's way into a life in the capital. The Plinths now enjoyed privileges that the oldest, most powerful families had earned over generations. It was unprecedented that Sejanus, a district-born boy, was a student at the academy. But his father's lavish donation had allowed for much of the school's post-war reconstruction. A capital-born citizen would have expected a building to be renamed for them. Sejanus's father had only requested an education for his son. For Coriolanus, the Plinths and their kind were a threat to all he held dear. The newly rich climbers in the capital were chipping away at the old order simply by virtue of their presence. It was particularly vexing because the bulk of the Snow family fortune had also been invested in munitions, but in District 13. Their sprawling complex, blocks and blocks of factories and research facilities, had been bombed to dust. District 13 had been nuked, and the entire area still emitted unlivable levels of radiation. The center of the capital's military manufacturing had shifted to District 2 and fallen right into the Plinth's laps. When news of District 13's demise had reached the capital, Coriolanus's grandmother had publicly brushed it off, saying it was fortunate that they had plenty of other assets. But they didn't. Sejanus had arrived on the school playground 10 years ago, a shy, sensitive boy, cautiously surveying the other children with a pair of soulful brown eyes, much too large for his strained face. When word had gotten out that he'd come from the districts, Coriolanus's first impulse had been to join his classmates' campaign to make the new kid's life a living hell. On further reflection, he'd ignored him. If the other capital children took this to mean that baiting the district brat was beneath him, Sejanus took it as decency. Neither take was quite accurate, but both reinforced the image of Coriolanus as a class act. A woman of formidable stature, Professor Sickle cruised into Soteria's circle, scattering her inferiors to the four winds. "Good morning, Professor Click."
"Oh, Agrippina, good. You remembered your shield," said Soteria, accepting a firm handshake. "It worries me that the young people will forget the real meaning of the day. And Sejanus, how smart you look."
Sejanus attempted a bow, sending a wayward lock of hair into his eyes. The cumbersome shield caught him in the chest. "Too smart," said Professor Sickle. "I told him if I wanted a peacock, I'd call the pet store. They should all be in their uniforms." She eyed Coriolanus. "That's not terrible. Your father's old mess dress shirt?" "Was it?" Coriolanus had no idea. A vague memory of his father in a dashing evening suit dripping in medals came to him. He decided to play out the hand. "Thank you for noticing, Professor. I had it redone so as not to suggest I'd seen combat myself, but I wanted him here with me today." "Very fitting," said Professor Sickle. Then she directed her attention to Soteria and her views on the latest deployment of peacekeepers, the nation's soldiers, to District 12, where the coal miners were failing to produce their quotas. With their teachers engaged, Coriolanus nodded at the shield. "Getting a workout this morning?" Sejanus gave a wry smile. "Always an honor to be of service." That's a fine polished job, Coriolanus replied. Sejanus tensed at the implication that he was, what, a suck-up? A lackey? Coriolanus let it build a moment before he diffused it. I should know, I do all Soteria's wine goblets. Sejanus relaxed at that. Really? No, not really, but only because she hasn't thought of it, said Coriolanus, seesawing between disdain and camaraderie. Professor Sickle thinks of everything. She doesn't hesitate to call me day or night. Sejanus looked as if he might continue, then just sighed. And of course, now that I'm graduating, we're moving closer to the school. Perfect timing, as usual. Coriolanus suddenly felt wary. Whereabouts? Somewhere on the Corso? A lot of those grand places will be going on the market soon. Owners not being able to afford the taxes or some such, my father said. The shield scraped the floor and Sejanus hefted it up. They don't tax properties in the capital. Only in the districts, said Coriolanus. It's a new law, Sejanus told him, to get more money for rebuilding the city. Coriolanus tried to tamp down the panic rising inside him. A new law? Instating a tax on his apartment? For how much? As it was, they barely eked out a living on Tigris's pittance, the tiny military pension his grandmother received for her husband's service to Pan Am, and his own dependent benefits as the child of a slain war hero, which would cease on graduation. If they couldn't pay the taxes, would they lose the apartment? It was all they had. Selling the place would be of no help. He knew his grandmother had borrowed every cent on it she could. If they sold, there would be next to nothing left. They would have to move to some obscure neighborhood and join the grimy ranks of everyday citizens, without status, without influence, without dignity. The disgrace would kill his grandmother. It would be kinder to toss her out the window of the penthouse. At least that would be quick. You all right? Sejanus peered at him, puzzled. You just went white as a sheet. Coriolanus regained his composure. I think it's the posca. Turns my stomach. Yeah, Sejanus agreed. Ma was always forcing it down me during the war. Ma? Was Coriolanus's place about to be usurped by someone who referred to his mother as Ma? The cabbage and posca threatened to make a reappearance. He took a deep breath and forced his stomach to hang on to it. Resenting Sejanus more than he had since the well-fed district boy with the cloddish accent first wandered up to him, clutching a bag of gumdrops. Coriolanus heard a bell ringing and saw his fellow students converging at the front of the dais. I guess it's time to assign us tributes, Sejanus said glumly. Coriolanus followed him to where a special section of chairs, 6 rows by 4, had been set up for the mentors. He tried to push the apartment crisis out of his head, to focus on the crucial task at hand. More than ever, it was essential that he excel, and to excel, he must be assigned a competitive tribute. Dean Casca Highbottom, the man credited with the creation of the Hunger Games, was overseeing the mentor program personally. He presented himself to the students with all the verve of a sleepwalker, dreamy-eyed and, as usual, doped up on morphling. His once fine physique was shrunken and draped with sagging skin. The close-clipped precision of a recent haircut and crisp suit only threw his deterioration into relief. Due to his fame as the game's inventor, he still had a tenuous hold on his position, but there were rumors that the Academy board was losing patience.
"Ho there!"
he slurred, waving a crumpled piece of paper over his head.
"Reading the things off now."
The students hushed, trying hard to hear him above the din of the hall.
"Read you a name, then you who gets that one, right? So fine. District 1, boy, goes to..."
Dean Highbottom squinted at the paper, trying hard to focus.
"Glasses," he mumbled. "Forgot them."
Everyone stared at his glasses, already perched on his nose, and waited while his fingers found them.
Ah, here we go. Livia Cardew.
Livia's pointed little face broke into a grin, and she punched the air in victory, shouting, "Yes!" in her shrill voice. She had always been prone to gloating, as if the plum assignment was solely a reflection on her, and not on her mother running the largest bank in the capital. Coriolanus felt increasing desperation as Dean Highbottom stumbled through the list, assigning each district's boy and girl a mentor. After 10 years, a pattern had emerged. The better-fed, more capital-friendly districts of 1 and 2 produced more victors, with the fishing and farming tributes from 4 and 11 also being contenders. Coriolanus had hoped for either a 1 or a 2, but neither was assigned to him, which was made more insulting when Sejanus scored the District 2 boy. District 4 passed without mention of his name, and his last real chance for a victor, the District 11 boy, was assigned to Clemencia Dovecote, daughter of the Energies Secretary. Unlike Livia, Clemencia received news of her good fortune with tact, pushing her sheet of raven hair over her shoulder as she studiously made note of her tribute in her binder. Something was amiss when a Snow, who also happened to be one of the Academy's high honor students, had gone unrecognized. Coriolanus was beginning to think they had forgotten him, perhaps they were giving him some special position, when to his horror he heard Dean Highbottom mumble,
"And last but least, District 12 girl, she belongs to Coriolanus Snow."
Chapter 2. The District 12 girl? Could there be a bigger slap in the face? District 12, the smallest district, the joke district, with its stunted, joint-swollen kids that always died in the first 5 minutes, and not only that, but the girl? Not that a girl couldn't win, but in his mind, the Hunger Games were largely about brute force, and the girls were naturally smaller than the boys and therefore at a disadvantage. Coriolanus had never been a particular favorite of Dean Highbottom, whom he jokingly called High as a Kite Bottom among his friends, but he had not expected such a public humiliation. Had the nickname gotten back to him? Or was this just an acknowledgement that, in the New World Order, the Snows were fading into insignificance? He could feel the blood burning his cheeks as he tried to remain composed. Most of the other students had risen and were chatting among themselves. He must join them, pretend this was of no consequence, but he seemed incapable of movement. The most he could manage was to turn his head to the right where Sejanus still sat beside him. Coriolanus opened his mouth to congratulate him, but stopped at the barely concealed misery on the other boy's face. "What is it?" he asked. "Aren't you happy? District 2, the boy. That's the pick of the litter."
"You forget. I'm part of that litter," said Sejanus hoarsely.
Coriolanus let that sink in. So 10 years in the capital, and the privileged life it provided had been wasted on Sejanus. He still thought of himself as a district citizen. Sentimental nonsense. Sejanus's forehead creased in consternation.
"I'm sure my father requested it. He's always trying to get my mind right."
No doubt, thought Coriolanus. Old Strabo Plinth's deep pockets and influence were respected, if his lineage was not. And while the mentorships were supposedly based on merit, strings clearly had been pulled. The audience had settled into seats now. At the back of the dais, curtains parted to reveal a floor-to-ceiling screen. The reaping aired live from each district, moving from the East Coast to the West, and was broadcast around the country. That meant District 12 would kick off the day. Everyone rose as the seal of Pan Am filled the screen, accompanied by the capital anthem. "Gem of Pan Am, mighty city, through the ages you shine anew." Some of the students fumbled for the words, but Coriolanus, who had heard his grandmother butcher it daily for years, sang all three verses in a forceful voice, garnering a few nods of approval. It was pathetic, but he needed every drop of approval he could get. The seal dissolved to show President Ravenstill, his hair streaked with silver, dressed in his pre-war military uniform as a reminder that he'd been controlling the districts long before the dark days of the rebellion. He recited a brief passage from the Treaty of Treason, which laid out the Hunger Games as a war reparation. Young district lives taken for the young capital lives that had been lost. The price of the rebels' treachery. The game makers cut to the bleak square of District 12, where a temporary stage, now lined with peacekeepers, had been erected before the Justice Building. Mayor Lip, a squat, freckled man in a hopelessly outdated suit, stood between two burlap sacks. He dug his hand deeply in the bag on his left, pulled out a slip of paper, and barely glanced at it. The District 12 girl tribute is Lucy Gray Baird, he said into a mic. The camera swept over the crowd of gray, hungry faces in gray, shapeless clothing seeking the tribute. It zoomed in toward a disturbance, girls drawing back from the unfortunate chosen one. The audience gave a surprised murmur at the sight of her. Lucy Gray Baird stood upright in a dress made of a rainbow of ruffles, now raggedy but once fancy. Her dark, curly hair was pulled up and woven with limp wildflowers. Her colorful ensemble drew the eye, as to a tattered butterfly in a field of moths. She did not make straight for the stage, but began to weave through the girls off to her right. It happened quickly. The dip of her hand into the ruffles at her hip, the wriggle of bright green transported from her pocket and deposited down the collar of a smirking redhead's blouse, the rustle of her skirt as she moved on. Focus stayed on the victim, her smirk changing to an expression of horror, her shrieks as she fell to the ground, pawing at her clothes, the shouts of the mayor. And in the background, her assailant was still weaving, still gliding her way to the stage, not looking back even once. Heavensby Hall came to life as people elbowed their neighbors. Did you see that? What did she drop down her dress? A lizard? I saw a snake. Did she kill her? Coriolanus scanned the crowd and felt a spark of hope. His long shot of a tribute, his throwaway, his insult had captured the capital's attention. That was good, right? With his help, perhaps she could keep it, and he could turn disgrace into a respectable showing. One way or another, their fates were irrevocably linked. Up on the screen, Mayor Lip flew down the steps of the stage, pushing his way through the assembled girls to reach the fallen one on the ground. "Mayfair? Mayfair?" he cried. "My daughter needs help!" A circle had opened up around her, but the few half-hearted attempts to help her were blocked by her thrashing limbs. The mayor broke into the clearing just as a small, iridescent green snake shot out of the folds of her dress and into the crowd, bringing screams and scrambles to avoid it. The departure of the snake calmed Mayfair, but her distress was immediately replaced by embarrassment. She looked straight into the camera as she realized all the citizens of Pan Am were watching. One hand tried to straighten a bow that had gone askew in her hair. The other moved to right her garments, filthy with the coal dust that coated everything and torn from her clawing. As her father helped her to her feet, it was apparent she had wet herself. He removed his jacket to wrap around her and handed her over to a peacekeeper to lead away. He turned back to the stage and trained a murderous look on District 12's newest tribute. As Coriolanus watched Lucy Gray Baird take the stage, he felt a stab of uneasiness. Could she be mentally unstable? There was something vaguely familiar but disturbing about her. The rows of raspberry pink, royal blue, and daffodil-yellow ruffles.
She's like a circus performer, one of the girls remarked.
The other mentors made sounds of agreement. That was it. Coriolanus reached back into his memory to the circuses of his early childhood. Jugglers and acrobats. Clowns and dancing girls in puffy dresses twirling around while his brain grew giddy with spun sugar. His tributes choosing such festive attire for the darkest event of the year showed a strangeness beyond a simple lapse of judgment. The allotted time for District 12's reaping had no doubt come and gone, but they still lacked a male tribute. Even so, when Mayor Lip retook the stage, he ignored the bags of names, made a beeline for the girl tribute, and struck her in the face so powerfully that she was knocked to her knees. He had raised his hand to hit her again when a couple of the peacekeepers intervened, grabbing his arms and attempting to redirect him to the business at hand. When he resisted, they hauled him back into the justice building, bringing the whole proceeding to a standstill. Attention shifted to the girl on the stage. As the camera zoomed in on her, Coriolanus was not reassured about Lucy Greybeard's sanity. Where she'd gotten the makeup, he had no idea, for it was only just becoming accessible again in the capital, but her eyes were shadowed blue and lined with black, her cheeks rouged, and her lips stained a somewhat greasy red. Here in the capital, it would have been bold. In District 12, it felt immoderate. She was impossible to look away from as she sat there running her hand over her skirt, compulsively smoothing the ruffles. Only when they were neatly arranged did she raise her hand to touch the mark on her cheek. Her lower lip trembled slightly, and her eyes shone with tears that threatened to spill over. "Don't cry," Coriolanus whispered. He caught himself and looked around nervously to find that the other students were riveted. Their faces showed concern. She had won their sympathy despite her oddness. They had no idea who she was or why she had attacked Mayfair, but who couldn't see that the smirking thing was spiteful and her father a brute who would flatten a girl he'd just sentenced to death? "I bet they rigged it," Sejanus said quietly. "Her name wasn't on that slip." Just as the girl was about to lose her battle with the tears, a strange thing happened. From somewhere in the crowd, a voice began to sing. A young voice, which might belong to either a boy or a girl, but of such a pitch that it carried across the silent square. "You can't take my past. You can't take my history." A puff of wind blew across the stage, and the girl slowly lifted her head. Somewhere else in the crowd, a deeper, distinctly male voice sang out. "You could take my pa, but his name's a mystery." The shadow of a smile played on Lucy Greybeard's lips. She suddenly pushed herself to her feet, strode to the center of the stage, grabbed the mic, and let loose. "Nothing you can take from me was ever worth keeping." Her free hand dug into the ruffles of her skirt, swishing it side to side, and all of it began to make sense. The costume, the makeup, her hair. Whoever she was, she had been dressed for a performance all along. She had a fine voice, bright and clear on the high notes, husky and rich on the low. And she moved with assurance. "You can't take my charm. You can't take my humor. You can't take my wealth, 'cause it's just a rumor. Nothing you can take from me was ever worth keeping." Singing transformed her, and Coriolanus no longer found her so disconcerting. There was something exciting, even attractive, about her. The camera drank her in as she crossed to the front of the stage and leaned out over the audience, sweet and insolent. "Thinking you're so fine, thinking you can have mine, thinking you're in control, thinking you'll change me, maybe rearrange me. Think again if that's your goal, 'cause—" And then she was off, sashaying around the stage, right past the peacekeepers, some of whom were having trouble suppressing smiles. None of them moved to stop her. "You can't take my sass. You can't take my talking. You can kiss my ass and then keep on walking. Nothing you can take from me was ever worth keeping." The doors to the Justice Building banged open, and the peacekeepers who had taken the mayor off burst back onto the stage. The girl was facing front, but you could see her register their arrival. She headed to the far end of the stage for her big finish. "No, sir. Nothing you can take from me is worth dirt. Take it, 'cause I give it free. It won't hurt. Nothing you can take from me was ever worth keeping." She managed to blow a kiss before they were on her. "My friends call me Lucy Gray. I hope you will too," she called out. One of the peacekeepers wrested the mic from her hand as another picked her up and carried her back to the middle of the stage. She waved as if to raucous applause, not dead silence. For a few moments, they were silent in Heavensby Hall as well. Coriolanus wondered if, like him, they were hoping she'd keep singing. Then everybody broke out talking, first about the girl, then about who'd been lucky enough to get her. The other students were craning their heads around, some giving him a thumbs up, some shooting resentful looks. He gave a bemused shake of his head, but inside he was glowing. Snow lands on top. Peacekeepers brought the mayor back out and planted themselves on either side of him to avoid further conflict. Lucy Gray ignored his return, having seemingly regained her poise by performing. The mayor glowered at the camera as he slapped his hand into the second bag and pulled several slips out. A few fluttered down to the stage, and he read the remaining paper. "The District 12 boy tribute is Jessup Diggs." The kids in the square stirred and made way for Jessup, a boy with a fringe of black hair plastered down on his prominent forehead. As District 12 tributes went, he was a fine specimen, bigger than average and strong-looking. His griminess suggested he was already employed in the mines. A half-hearted attempt at washing had revealed a relatively clean oval in the middle of his face. But it was ringed with black, and coal dust caked his nails. Awkwardly, he ascended the stairs to take his place. As he neared the mayor, Lucy Gray stepped forward and extended her hand. The boy hesitated, then reached out and shook. Lucy Gray crossed in front of him, switched her right hand for her left, and they were standing side by side holding hands when she made a deep curtsy, pulling the boy into a bow. A smattering of applause and a lone whoop came from the District 12 crowd before the peacekeepers closed in, and the reaping broadcast cut to District 8. Coriolanus acted engrossed in the show as 8, 6, and 11 called their tributes, but his brain spun with the repercussions of landing Lucy Gray Baird. She was a gift, he knew it, and he must treat her as such. But how best to exploit her show-stopping entrance? How to wrangle some success from a dress, a snake, a song? The tributes would be given precious little time with the audience before the games began. How could he get the audience to invest in her, and by extension, him, in just an interview? He half-registered the other tributes, mostly pitiful creatures, and took note of the stronger ones. Sejanus got a towering fellow from District 2, and Livia's District 1 boy looked like he could be a contender as well. Coriolanus's girl seemed fairly healthy, but her slight build was more suited to dancing than hand-to-hand combat. He bet she could run fast enough, though, and that was important. As the reaping drew to a close, the smell of food from the buffet wafted over the audience. Fresh-baked bread, onions, meat. Coriolanus could not keep his stomach from growling, and risked another couple swallows of Posca to quiet it. He felt wired, light-headed, and ravenous. After the screen went dark, he had to use all the discipline he could muster not to rush for the buffet. The endless dance with hunger had defined his life. Not the very early years, before the war, but every day since had been a battle, a negotiation, a game. How was it best to stave off hunger? Eat all the food at one meal? Spread it through the day in dribs and drabs? Wolf it down or chew every morsel to liquid? It was all just a mind game to distract himself from the fact that it was never enough. No one would ever let him have enough. During the war, the rebels had held the food-producing districts. Taking a page out of the capital's playbook, they tried to starve the capital into submission using food, or a lack thereof, as a weapon. Now the tables had turned again, with the capital controlling the supply and taking it one step further, twisting the knife into the district's hearts with the Hunger Games. Amid the violence of the games, there was a silent agony that everyone in Pan Am had experienced. The desperation for enough sustenance to bring you to the following sunrise. That desperation had turned upstanding capital citizens into monsters. People who dropped dead from starvation in the streets became part of a gruesome food chain. One winter's night, Coriolanus and Tigris had slipped out of the apartment to scavenge some wooden crates they'd spotted earlier in an alley. On the way, they passed three bodies, recognizing one as that of a young maid who served tea so nicely at the Crane's afternoon gatherings. A heavy, wet snow began falling, and they thought the streets deserted. But on the way home, a bundled figure sent them scurrying behind a hedge. They watched as their neighbor, Nero Price, a titan in the railroad industry, carved the leg from the maid, sawing back and forth with a terrifying knife until the limb came free. He wrapped it in the skirt he ripped from her waist and then bolted down the side street that led to the back of his townhouse. The cousins never spoke of it, even to each other, but it was burned into Coriolanus's memory. The savagery distorting Price's face, the white anklet and scuffed black shoe at the end of the severed limb, and the absolute horror of realizing that he, too, could now be viewed as edible. Coriolanus credited both his literal and moral survival to the Grand Mam's foresight early in the war. His parents were dead, Tigris orphaned as well, and both children were living with their grandmother. The rebels had been making slow but steady progress to the capital, although arrogance kept that reality from being widely acknowledged in the city. Food shortages required even the richest to seek out certain supplies on the black market. That was how Coriolanus found himself at the back door of a once trendy nightclub one late October afternoon, holding the handle of a small red wagon in one hand and the Grand Mam's gloved hand in the other. There was a bitter chill in the air that warned ominously of winter, and a blanket of gloomy gray clouds overhead. They had come to see Pluribus Bell, an aging man with lemon-tinted spectacles and a white powdered wig that fell to his waist. He and his partner Cyrus, a musician, owned the shuttered club and now made do by trafficking goods from its back alley. The Snows had come for a case of canned milk, the fresh stuff having disappeared weeks ago, but Pluribus said he was sold out. What had just arrived were crates of dried lima beans, stacked high on the mirrored stage behind him.
"They'll keep for years," Pluribus promised the Grand Mam. "I plan on setting aside 20 or so for personal use."
Coriolanus's grandmother had laughed.
"How ghastly."
"No, my dear. Ghastly is what happens without them," Pluribus said.
He didn't elaborate, but the Grand Mam stopped laughing. She shot a look at Coriolanus, and her hand clenched his for a second. It seemed involuntary, almost a spasm. Then she looked at the crates and appeared to be figuring something in her head.
"How many can you spare?" she asked the club owner.
Coriolanus pulled one crate home in his wagon, and the other 29 arrived in the dead of night, as hoarding was technically illegal. Cyrus and a friend hauled the crates up the stairs and piled them in the middle of the lavishly furnished living room. On the top of the pile, they placed a single can of milk. Compliments of Pluribus.
then bid them good night. Coriolanus and Tigris helped the Grand Mam hide them in closets, in fancy wardrobes, even in the old clock. "Who's going to eat all these?" he asked. At this time there was still bacon in his life, and chicken, and the occasional roast. Milk was spotty, but cheese plentiful, and some sort of dessert could be counted on at dinner, even if it was just jam bread. "We'll eat some. Perhaps we can trade," said the Grand Mam. "They'll be our secret." "I don't like lima beans," Coriolanus pouted. "At least I don't think I do." "Well, we'll have cook find a good recipe," said the Grand Mam.
But the cook had been called to serve in the war, then died of the flu. The Grand Mam, it turned out, did not even know how to turn on the stove, let alone follow a recipe. It fell to 8-year-old Tigris to boil the beans to the thick stew, then the soup, then the watery broth, which was to sustain them throughout the war. Lima beans, cabbage, the ration of bread. They lived on it day in, day out, for years. Surely it had impeded his growth. Surely he would be taller, his shoulders broader, had he had more food. But his brain had developed properly. At least he hoped it had. Beans, cabbage, brown bread. Coriolanus grew to hate the stuff, but it kept them alive, without shame, and without cannibalizing the dead bodies in the streets. Coriolanus swallowed the saliva flooding his mouth as he reached for the gilt-edged plate embossed with the Academy's seal. Even in the leanest days, the capital had not lacked fancy dishware, and he had eaten many a cabbage leaf from fine china at home. He collected a linen napkin, a fork, a knife. As he raised the lid on the first sterling silver chafing dish, the steam bathed his lips. Creamed onions. He took a modest spoonful and tried not to drool. Boiled potatoes. Summer squash. Baked ham. Hot rolls and a pat of butter. On second thought, 2 pats. A full plate, but not a greedy one. Not for a teenage boy. He set his plate on the table next to Clemencia and went to retrieve his dessert from a cart, because last year they had run out and he'd missed the tapioca entirely. His heart skipped a beat when he saw the rows of apple pie wedges, each decorated with a paper flag sporting the seal of Pan Am. Pie! When had he last tasted that? He was reaching for a medium-sized piece when someone thrust a plate with an enormous slice under his nose.
"Oh, take a big one. Growing boy like you can handle it."
Dean Highbottom's eyes were rheumy, but they had lost the glazed look of the morning. In fact, they were trained on Coriolanus with an unexpected sharpness. He took the plate of pie with a grin he hoped was boyishly good-natured.
"Thank you, sir. I can always find room for pie."
"Yes. Pleasures are never hard to accommodate," said the dean. "No one would know better than I."
"I suppose not, sir."
But that sounded wrong. He had meant to agree with the part about pleasures, but it sounded like a snide remark about the dean's character.
"You suppose not."
Dean Highbottom's eyes narrowed as he continued to stare at Coriolanus.
"So, what are your plans, Coriolanus, after the games?"
"I hope to go on to university," he replied.
What a strange question. Surely his academic record made that evident.
"Yes, I saw your name among the prize contenders," said Dean Highbottom. "But if you shouldn't be awarded one?"
Coriolanus stammered. "Well, then, we'd pay the tuition, of course."
"Would you?" Dean Highbottom laughed. "Look at you, in your makeshift shirt and your too tight shoes, trying to hold it together, strutting around the capital when I doubt the Snows have a pot to piss in. Even with a prize, it would be a stretch, and you don't yet have one, do you? What then, I wonder, would happen to you? What then?" Coriolanus could not help but glance around to see who else had heard the terrible words, but most people were engaged in mealtime chatter. "Don't worry,"